Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In January 2009, as the country was celebrating the inauguration of its first African-American president, in Indian Wells, California, there was another gathering underway. The multi-billionaire Charles Koch invited a group of anti-tax, anti-government, super-wealthy businessmen to come up with a plan to stop President Obama from going forward with what they called his catastrophic policies. In her new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, today's guest, investigative journalist Jane Mayer, writes that by the time Barack Obama was elected president, the billionaire Koch brothers' operation had become even more sophisticated by persuading an expanding hand-picked list of wealthy conservatives to invest with them. They have, in effect, created a private political bank, funding hundreds of interlocking organizations to influence and ultimately control academic institutions, state houses, the courts, Congress, and the presidency. So-called outside money exploded during the Obama years. Much attention was paid to the portion of this spending that was directed at elections, but less attention was paid to the equally unrivaled role that outside money played in influencing the way the country was governed. And that money and the Koch brothers and their groups have been wildly successful. Jane Mayer reports that advisors to President Obama acknowledged that he had no idea what he was up against. Jane Mayer is an award-winning investigative journalist and staff writer at The New Yorker. She's author of the 2008 New York Times bestseller, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Her new book, Dark Money, is The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Well, it is so good to have you, and thank you for revealing so much information. You reveal the names of so many influential people most of us have never heard of, in large part because of Citizens United. And you spent 5 years conducting hundreds of interviews. You studied public records, private papers, and court proceedings. Talk about the research process involved in all of this.
Well, it was kind of time-consuming and tough because the Koch brothers are known for their secrecy. Charles Koch always had a kind of a motto, which was that it's when the whale spouts that it gets harpooned. And so he had been trying to sort of swim under the surface for a number of years without getting harpooned. And neither Charles nor David Koch, the brothers themselves, would give me an interview, but I didn't want to let that be determinant in terms of whether I'd be able to write about them, because they play such an important role in American politics. So I just kept digging and went through all kinds of records, eventually got some new documents that people had never seen before, and interviewed hundreds of people around the Kochs, people, members of their family, friends, enemies, colleagues, people that they've worked with off and on in different capacities, and eventually, you know, a consistent picture came together that allowed me to sort of fill in this kind of secret history.
You reveal why, for the past couple of decades, we have seen the erosion of social safety programs, deepening inequality, the influence of money at every level of the political process. Dark money is also connected to the rise and normalization of anti-tax, anti-government rhetoric in the United States. And these libertarian views were once far outside of the mainstream, but that's no longer the case, thanks to the group that the Koch brothers have brought together. You've written so many articles about their influence and how they operate, and I wish we had all day to go over everything you reveal in the book, but we don't. So what struck you the most about the extent of their influence?
I think of all the issues where you can see their fingerprints the most, it may be the one where they've had the most impact is about climate change. The Koch Industries, the private company owned by Charles and David Koch, is a fossil fuel company to a large extent. It's a conglomerate, but it does $115 billion worth of business a year. Each of the brothers is now worth something like $45 billion apiece, and they're hugely invested in fossil fuels, and they have absolutely tied up the Congress in knots when it comes to taking action on climate change. And part of the reason I wanted to write the book was I, like many Americans, I wondered why is it that Congress seems so dysfunctional? Why can't, you know, many Americans agree on a number of problems that need solutions and even agree on a number of solutions, but somehow nothing gets done. And so the answer to some extent is that there is a small group of interests that really profit from nothing getting done, and particularly on climate change, they profit from there being no kind of tax on carbon pollution and no move towards alternative fuels. And the Kochs and the 400 or 500 very, very wealthy other investors, as they call them, who've pooled their resources together, have just had a huge impact on keeping anyone who wants to do some sort of reform on climate change from getting elected, on confusing the American public about what the real science shows, on trying to scare the American public into thinking that if anything is done on this issue, it will be prohibitively expensive and hurt people in this country. And for all these reasons, the fortune that's being spent to stop reform on this subject has been pretty effective. So you see, in this country, the Congress of the United States is going in the exact opposite direction from the entire rest of the world and from where science is. And a lot of that is because of these billionaires' money, the way they've spent it.
You have some very clear-cut examples in your book about Republicans who at one time acknowledged climate change and said we really need to take action. Mitt Romney's a good example. Before he was running for president, in a book that he wrote, he talked about climate change. But then once the Koch brothers got to him, I mean, he really wanted their money and their endorsement, he completely did a 180, and you have several examples like that in your book.
It is pretty incredible. There's another reporter who writes about this issue who describes it as a naked belly crawl as the politicians see the money and realize that they're going to have to, you know, completely change their tune, and many of them do. A couple of them don't. I write about some terrific people in this book who decided that climate change was real and something needed to be done about it, and then found themselves targeted by the Koch political machine. One was a Republican and one was a very conservative Democrat. They were just knocked out in terms of the kind of advertisements that were taken out against them, and their opponents were boosted by front groups that are quietly and sort of indirectly funded by the Kochs and their donor group.
The information you revealed, Jane, also, I think, pokes a huge hole in the frame that the media often repeat, and that is Congress is broken. Democrats and Republicans don't want to work together, as if Congress is broken equally, because both sides are angry with each other, both sides are beholden to their constituents and these special interests, and therefore that's why nothing gets done.
You know, it's kind of easy but lazy reporting to say that both sides are equal. This is I admire, actually, there were two political scientists from the Brookings Institute, Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann, who finally came out a couple years ago with a book that's called It's Worse Than You Think, that lays it on the line. The truth is the Democrats, while they have their problems, are nowhere near as radical or obstructionist at this point as the Republicans are. The Republicans have just gone off a cliff, practically, in terms of following the far-right money interests in Congress. And it's created just a wall of obstruction for everything that Obama wants to do. So there's been very little compromise, as we've seen. And part of what I wanted to do here was figure out why did the right get so radical? And a lot of the reason is the donor base is so radical, much more radical than most kind of rank-and-file Americans are.
Well, we often hear the Koch brothers, that term thrown around, without much information about who they actually are. So let's talk a little bit about that just quickly. In 1980, David Koch ran for VP of the United States on the Libertarian ticket and received 1% of the vote. And at that time, the conservative icon William F. Buckley Jr. dismissed his view and his brother's view as anarcho-totalitarianism. I mean, William Buckley said that about the Koch brothers.
Right. And so this is really one of the great questions, I think, about American politics. So how did these two brothers in particular, who were so far out on the right fringe in 1980 that they got less than 1% of the vote, they ran against Ronald Reagan from the right because they thought Reagan was too much of a liberal sellout, and they were denounced by William F. Buckley as sort of the fringe. So how did they get from there to the center of gravity in the Republican Party at this point? And the answer is, over the 40 years between then and now, there has been just a concerted, comprehensive effort on the part of the Kochs and a few other super wealthy families who were very conservative to change American politics, to push it hard to the right, to convince American voters that the government is a force for evil, not good, and in every way change the conversation in America.
And you remind us that the Koch family owned 4,000 miles of pipelines, oil refineries in Alaska, Texas, Minnesota, the Georgia Pacific Lumber and Paper Company, coal and chemicals, and they were huge traders in commodity futures, among other businesses. Now, even though they said that Obama's policies would be catastrophic to the economy, you report that Charles and David's personal fortunes had nearly tripled during his presidency, and this is according to Forbes, from $14 billion apiece in March 2009 to $41.6 billion each in March 2015. So they have done very well under President Obama.
They've done really well, but they would like to do better still, I think, because they've been pushing very hard to have their taxes lowered and corporate taxes lowered further and the regulations weakened that govern companies like theirs. With, you know, they've got a long, Koch Industries has a long and checkered legal history of pollution, among other problems, and that the Kochs have been working very hard to try to change the criminal justice system so that white-collar criminals can be treated more leniently. Because they themselves, they've been quite open about it. They've explained that they felt that they were unfairly treated when they were prosecuted for leaking benzene from one particular refinery. Benzene is a carcinogen. And they were hit pretty hard with a big, big fine. And they've had a long history of this kind of behavior. So at any rate, they may look like they're doing well, but they can certainly see ways they could do better.
Talk about some of the other major players. You report that no fewer than 18 billionaires would be among the doers joining the Kochs opposition movement during the first term of Obama's presidency. Their combined fortunes as of last year topped $214 billion. Coal, oil, and gas magnates formed the nucleus of the donor network. You've got Stephen Schwarzman. He runs the private equity firm Blackstone. Ken Langone, the billionaire founder of Home Depot. Who else is in this group? Maybe talk about a few people that a lot of us have never heard of.
Well, the financiers are very important to this group. I mean, as you mentioned, that there are also the fossil fuel interests. There are a couple of the major frackers in the country. The largest owner of coal in the company, someone named Corbin Benson, biggest owner of private coal in America. But there are also huge financiers. Stephen Cohen, people might remember, who ran SAC Capital, which was constantly being investigated and prosecuted for insider trading, is a member of this group that most people don't realize is part of it. The Bechtel family from the San Francisco area has been very involved in the Koch donor summits. Phil Anschutz from Quest Communications, who's an oil man and involved in many other things too, huge businessman, is also involved. I mean, these are names that in the corporate community are huge in the Forbes the list of the Forbes 400 richest people in America, and then there's some people who you wouldn't know of unless they're enormously wealthy, but they're kind of the invisible rich often. They're the people who own private companies, so they don't get that much attention, but many are in the home building business, and some from the Midwest, and they're billionaires, but they're kind of the billionaires next door that don't get a lot of attention, and they're hugely conservative.
And the meetings that these people attend are very secret. People cannot take any devices inside the gathering. The hotel staff were checked. Audio technicians placed white noise-emitting loudspeakers around the perimeters of these hotels. I mean, this almost sounds like a spy novel.
I know. I love some of the details. I have to say that the static-making machine that they had at one of these meetings was a great touch, I thought. That was when reporters began to try to eavesdrop on what was going on in these meetings, because it is an extraordinary situation where you've got 400 or 500 of the richest and most conservative people in the country meeting together to influence the political outcome for everybody in the country, but they don't want anyone to know who they are. It's like a secret group and with its own private bank. And so it's become almost a kind of a game for reporters to try to figure out who they are. And luckily, a full guest list was left behind once, and that gave us something of a blueprint. And then there have been many more hints since then.
This year, the Koch-funded network is expected to spend $889 million. And Jane, when I was reading your book, it was hard to keep up with the names, the think tanks, the political action committees. I mean, I had to continue to flip back to kind of make a reference because there are just so many. I mean, how big is this network?
Well, so it's funny. There's a nickname that has been given to the Koch's machine, their political machine, and it was coined by a libertarian, actually. They call the Koch's machine the Kochtopus because it seems to have so many different tentacles reaching out in so many different directions. And you know, it varies from year to year how many groups they are funding, but it's dozens and dozens of groups that appear to be independent from the outside, but if you flip them over and look at the funding stream underneath them, it keeps coming back to the same very small group of very wealthy and very ultra-conservative people.
Jane Mayer is author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Her last book was called The Dark Side. Jane Mayer is a reporter with The New Yorker, and she writes about the Koch brothers and this fairly small network of billionaires with extreme libertarian views that have bankrolled a plan to fundamentally alter the American political system. And they have been wildly successful, especially when you look at what's happening across the country at the state level. And we'll talk about that on today's show. If you have any questions for Jane Mayer, we'd love to hear from you. The Koch brothers are getting a lot more attention these days, but do you feel like you're really getting the information you need about who they are, their worldview, and the influence they have across the country? You'd think at a time when so many people are talking about the role that money in politics has on the United States, these issues would be getting a lot more attention. The toll-free number is 866.
You are listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We can't accept calls at this time, but thank you.
You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
This is literally like a deja vu for me. I remember during the Ralph Nader campaign that I used to advocate constantly, over and over again, strenuously, that rather than go directly to a national platform, you need the people who are looking for reform and to counteract the action of people like the Koch brothers and their group is to build a local infrastructure, local political infrastructure. And once you've built that base, move it on to another local, and then move it on to the state, and then move it on to a federal national platform. So a lot of what happened is it allowed the Koch brothers to form is literally the fault of the people who refused to counter them by working together at that local level. All they did was pick up a very simple idea: if we control local politics, then we can actually control national politics, and no one's going to look at us as we control one area after another, after an isolated area after another,
well,
and build gerrymandering. So all they did it was in a strategic manner where the left refuses to.
Well, thank you for calling. I mean, the game has changed because of Citizens United, and so now you've got all this money at the state level. And let's talk about this, Jane, since Robert brought it up. You write about Ed Gillespie. He became the chair of the Republican National Committee in 2003, And as soon as the court handed down its Citizens United decision, Gillespie set out to Texas with Karl Rove to pitch deep-pocketed oil men at the Dallas Petroleum Club on a plan to fund a new kind of shadow political machine. Tell us about that and the plans that he had at the state level.
Well, right. So what they wanted to do then was get the big wealthy donors to pool their money in kind of private banks. Instead of going through the national political parties, they could just create their own pool of money, and the operatives could then target it to wherever they thought it was most important. And what was really important about 2010, it was a midterm election year, but it was also the year when the census comes out. It happens every decade. And the census is the study on which the new congressional districts are based. And so, what Ed Gillespie and Karl Rove and a few others realized was that if they could take over state legislatures by conservative Republicans that year, the following year when they drew up the congressional districts, they'd be in the driver's seat in terms of being able to gerrymander all the congressional districts across the country. And so that's what they were aiming for. They called it Red Map. It was a sort of a kind of secret program. It was funded by a lot of dark money, that is, undisclosed donations that are very hard to follow. They were brilliant at it. They by the end of 2010, they picked up 675 state legislative seats in the country, and many of the state houses flipped from Democratic to Republican control. And the following year, these districts were redrawn, so to the advantage of Republicans, and created kind of a firewall for Republican candidates who were running for Congress. So they have been very strategic, and they have been very local, as your caller said. And part of it, I think you have to go back to thinking about who the Kochs are. But Charles and David Koch are both engineers, and they're both graduates of MIT. And they have looked at the American political system as engineers would. They're thinking about it systemically. They've kind of tried to figure out, well, what are the widgets that you need to turn in order to create political change? And they've kind of built up a machine that is like an assembly line for creating massive political change in America. So they've done a lot of focus at the state level. They've got state think tanks in every state that are conservative, sources of conservative opinion and expert papers and things in every state. It's called the State Policy Network. They've got the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a well-known organization by now, but was set up so that business interests in each state capital could dictate legislation to state legislators, who would then kind of write bills in favor of the corporate interests in their state. And then they've got national think tanks and national pressure groups that mobilize public support for these policies at every level. The Kochs have been involved at this point now in such a granular level that they've even gotten poured money into school board races in Colorado. They got involved in a local issue about whether to fund a zoo in Ohio. I mean, they've been fighting Medicaid expansion in many states. It's very much more active at the local and state level than at the national level, really.
Well, after the break, we will talk about why North Carolina in particular was one of their testing grounds for the Red Map strategy. And again, the Koch brothers and their group were wildly successful in states across the country, particularly in North Carolina. Today, we're joined by The New Yorker's Jane Mayer. She's out with a new book called Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. What questions do you have about the Koch brothers and the group that they have assembled to take on not only the White House, but also states across the country? This year, they are expected to spend almost $1 billion. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with The New Yorker's Jane Mayer about her new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. We often hear that a popular uprising against big government has led to a broad-based conservative movement. We almost hear this almost daily. Washington is broken. The Democrats and the Republicans refuse to work together. But Jane says what we really need to focus on is a small network of billionaires with extreme libertarian views that have bankrolled a plan to fundamentally alter the American political system. The Democrats probably wish they had something like this, but as Jane reports, they don't. There's really no comparison. So if you have any questions for Jane Mayer about what she found, she spent 5 years doing research on this book. We'd love to hear from you. 866.
You are listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, so we're not accepting calls at this time, but thank you.
5-5. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jane, we were talking about the massive gains that Republicans got after 2010 and 2014, and you focus on North Carolina because that was one of the places that they wanted to use as a test case. So tell us what happened in North Carolina.
Well, it really was kind of their test kitchen. They wanted to see if you could pour in enough money, whether big money could really change government at the state level. And what happened was the legislature flipped from Democratic to Republican control, and the person who was a member of the Koch Investor Network in North Carolina, who's been most active from that state and who's been working with Kochs for a long time, he's a multi-millionaire named Art Pope, turned around and became the budget director for the whole state. So it put him in charge of designing the budget, and he was then in a position to implement many of the sort of dream ideas that the Kochs had and the other investors had for how government should really work.
And things changed quite dramatically in North Carolina. I mean, laws changed almost overnight. Can you give us just a rundown?
Yeah, it was a kind of a radical reversal, and it still is. It's creating all kinds of controversy in North Carolina. North Carolina traditionally is kind of a purple state. It swings back and forth between red and blue, but it has some of both. But it became a kind of a crimson-red state after 2010. Among the issues that have been most controversial is the legislature passed some very strict voter laws that are going to make it hard for very low-income people without the certain kinds of IDs to vote. So it's had more restrictive voting rules. They lowered taxes on the very upper earners. They lowered estate taxes, that is, inheritance taxes, in such a way that only a handful of people benefited, but they benefited hugely. All kinds of regulations were rolled back on environmental practices and pollution, and the schools became strapped. And that is one of the things that's really been controversial in North Carolina, because the schools have been really the reason why North Carolina has pulled ahead of many other southern states. It's a place that's been very proud of its educational system.
And Bob Phillips, the head of the North Carolina chapter of Common Cause, told you that Citizens United was a huge game changer. He said it enabled a single donor to completely change the makeup of the state.
Well, this is this one man, Art Pope, who runs a kind of a five and dime store empire. It's called Variety Wholesalers, and it's a family business that he says he didn't inherit it, but put it this way, his father built it, and now he runs it. And he's had a tremendous, this one man, by channeling his own fortune into the state and working with the Kochs and sort of building up these organizations, has a titanic influence at the state level. It's fascinating. I mean, it shows you what you can do in this country if you're really focused and you have enough money and you're very ambitious about wanting to put your imprint on politics.
Jane Mayer is the author of Dark Money, and we have full lines. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. This is really an important program. I'm reminded of what Abraham Lincoln said, that you can fool some of the people all the time. And I'm afraid that's true for American people as well. My question is this. With all of the money flowing into the Republican coffers, should Hillary Clinton be given a pass for all of the money she's taking from Wall Street in order to combat the money that the Republicans are getting from people like the Koch brothers?
Well, I mean, this is the issue. Is it's the situation now with this unlimited spending after Citizens United is creating a problem of sort of mutual assured destruction. Both sides have to compete if they want to survive at all. The Democrats say they are in favor of campaign finance reform and want to see limits, but if they abstained from getting money, they would likely have a very hard time competing. Bernie Sanders, though, of course, has built a different model a little bit. It remains to be seen how far he can go with it, though. But on building small donations and using the internet to build them up, I mean, it's kind of following the Obama mode too. But it's a problem. Big money, put it this way, is a bipartisan problem because the laws make it impossible for people to run for office without just coming up with unthinkably huge amounts of money.
What do you think about the frame, Jane? The Republicans have the Kochs and the Democrats have George Soros and Tom Steyer. That's what we often hear.
Right. It is something people say all the time. Well, there are a couple differences. First of all, Steyer and Soros give disclosed donations. They're both in favor of transparency. So you don't see the secret spending that you get from the Koch network, which hides its hands. And so, I mean, I think that's a very big issue, and I'm as a reporter, very much in favor of transparency and think the American public deserves to know who's spending and why and what they want. And so that's one big difference. But I don't think it's great for the country to have billionaires on either side exerting disproportionate influence over everybody's fate just because they have so much money.
You've got some interesting behind-the-scenes information in your book, Jane. Apparently Barack Obama was completely shocked and taken aback by the amount of money that was poured into the campaigns, even at the state level. And at one point, he said, well, we have really no choice but to start a super PAC because there's no way we can go up against this.
Well, this is the thing. The Democrats are having to do compete, but they're doing it sort of holding their noses because these are not policies they like. They don't like the sort of building up these huge campaign war chests and being beholden to private interests, but they have to if they're going to be able to compete. So it's an awful dilemma that they're in, and it suggests that it's the laws themselves that have to be changed. The rules of the game have been changed drastically in just the last couple decades. They've been so watered down. I mean, there really were campaign finance restrictions not very long ago. And now there are just no brakes on the system. And that's what's got to change.
In 2008, Barack Obama banned donations from federal lobbyists and political action committees. And a lot of people are really angry because just in the last couple days, the Democratic National Committee rolled back those restrictions.
Right. I mean, and again, they have to go back to the same well, the same sort of polluted well, in order to survive in politics here. I mean, and so it's a mess of a situation. I don't think it's irresolvable, though. One of the things that's interesting is that there's huge public opinion in favor of reforming money in politics. It's bipartisan. Something like 90% of people dislike the Citizens United decision, and 84% think there's too much money in politics. That means a lot of Republicans along with a lot of Democrats. And they're disgusted, I think, in what's going on. And so if some of that disgust can be harnessed in a positive way, I think you really would see change.
We have a question from Robert in Oakland who says, what is your opinion on Bernie Sanders' grassroots funding and volunteering as an antidote to Koch spending without waiting for Citizens United to be overturned?
Well, I mean, I think it's been very smart of him, and I think the outpouring of support in a way for both Sanders and Trump, ironically enough, is, I think, a protest vote to some extent against the sense that many Americans have that the conventional candidates on the Democratic and certainly on the Republican side are kind of owned and bought by the big donors. And I think the public is upset about it. I mean, I, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, I think left, right, center, or something else, very few Americans like the idea that 400 or 500 of the richest people in the country are going to choose the next leader and dictate the country's policies, you know. So I think that that is what's fueling a lot of the support for Bernie Sanders. He's calling out the corruption of the campaign finance system very loudly, and kind of oddly, Trump is too, even though it's an irony because the only reason he can do it is because he's a billionaire and so rich himself, he can say, I'm not beholden to anyone else.
And he also greatly benefits from many of their policies.
Which policies?
The policies that the Koch brothers are advocating for.
Well, certainly the tax policies that many of these big donors are pushing are policies that immediately aid their bottom lines. And they may say it's all about sort of pure libertarian philosophy, and they may believe it, and they are often true believers. But at the same time, I think the rest of the country can stand back and take a look and say, well, wait a minute now, what's going on here? You may say these policies are good for everyone, but they certainly seem to be good for the top brackets first. And that is the truth if you take a look at, you know, any kind of statistical analysis of these tax policies.
Jane Mayer is author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And you can join us at 866-798-8255.
We are listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We're not accepting calls at this time, but thank you for listening.
Lewis in Berkeley. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm compiling what could be an appendix to the Dark Money book on the influence of Koch opposition to transit projects across the United States. They've actually stopped more than a dozen transit projects trying to come to fruition after years of struggle and development process, and mostly in the Midwest, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, etc. I've uncovered probing San Francisco to stop transit development. They've been very successful in Honolulu. One of the things that's interesting in this research that parallels what's in the Dark Money work by Jane is the influence of older, largely white retirees, probably a little bit higher in income, that gather in some form of political activity, whether it's country clubs or Republican Party. And if you open every Koch foundation, the first thing that comes out is on the first page is to join. There's dozens of these. They all open the same way. The first page is always the same way. And it's really all aimed at largely, not all, but largely aimed at this older, white, wealthier cohort.
All right. Lewis, thank you for calling in. First off, Jane, did you run across any information about the Koch shutting down rail systems in your research?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, again, you know, people sort of say, well, I don't see any evidence that they're buying the 2016 election. The presidential election is just one arena of what's going on right now. There is so much activity on the part of Koch-funded groups all across this country on so many different levels. It's kind of dizzying. Mm. And mass transit and rail are areas that they have gotten involved in. I remember there was one particularly interesting fight. I think it was in Tennessee, where the locality had come up, spent years designing a new system that was sort of public transportation, and the Koch money came in and pretty much knocked it out because they argued that it was going to be too expensive. And truthfully, the Koch's philosophy is that government should do almost nothing, that there should be almost no public kinds of transportation or anything else, that the only role of the government should be to look after private property. And so they oppose all kinds of civic programs and public programs all across the country.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, Jane. I mean, it's a big question, but what is their end game here? Because you've got so much information about how they don't want social programs. They believe that if the poor needs help, it should come from philanthropy and private contributions to churches, for example. You write about how they went ballistic after Obamacare passed and spent over $200 million on TV ads railing against it. They also went ballistic when President Obama was talking about economic stimulus. They adamantly opposed that. So what is their end game here? Because you also write about how they are greatly also contributing so much money to higher education institutions.
But they're contributing money to private education institutions in order to fund programs to teach kids their own philosophy. And the philosophy is basically that private enterprise should rule, that business and the free market should determine what people's lives are like. And you're either a winner or a loser in that world, but it should not be the government's role to intervene. So that's a kind of a simplification, but that is their philosophy. And they, you know, would argue from the start, the Koch family, including their father, had opposed Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, want to see the abolition of the IRS because they really have opposed the tax system so mightily. And they are, you know, the book is about radical right, members of the radical right, and they are radicals. And what's interesting is that they've gotten such a foothold in a country that's so filled with centrists, really.
You write about the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. The Kochs are directing millions of dollars into online education and this nonprofit that Charles Koch devised called the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. The financially pressed Topeka school system signed an agreement with the organization, which taught students that, among other things, Franklin Roosevelt did not alleviate the Depression, minimum wage laws and public assistance hurt the poor, lower pay for women was not discriminatory, and the government, rather than business, caused the 2008 recession. Is this still being taught today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Kochs are funding really an alternative, a revisionist view of American history. And Charles Koch's been involved in this, again, since the 1970 or so. He was a trustee at a very strange school called the Freedom School that was in Colorado that taught that the robber barons were America's heroes. And that it was described to me by another libertarian as a small group of people who thought that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was a tragic mistake. And they have been pretty much inveighing against any kind of activist progressive government, including any of the changes that came from the New Deal, almost since the New Deal. It's so that is their vision, and they're teaching it to kids in schools, not just in high schools, but the Kochs currently fund something like between 200 and 300 different programs, academic programs, in American colleges and universities.
And what about the Kauffman Foundation?
It's not ringing a bell with me right this second, but there are so many different groups. Which one were you thinking of?
It's an education organization.
Are you thinking of the Olin Foundation? The Olin Foundation is one that I write about at great length. There's both the Olin and Bradley Foundation, and they are, again, foundations, private foundations that are funded by extraordinarily wealthy right-wing families, where they discovered that they could use their private foundations and philanthropic gifts to fund kind of political activism and take tax deductions at the same time, because it was considered a sort of philanthropic charitable activity.
Jane Mayer is the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jane, what are your thoughts on where this is going at a time when so many people are talking about money in politics and basically saying that perhaps if Obama elects the next Supreme Court justice, there might be a chance to overturn Citizens United?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing is why this is going to be such a fight and why the stakes are so high in the issue of who replaces Scalia on the court.
Right.
I mean, really, what we're looking at is this: there are two dramatically different versions of how politics should be played in this country, and they're kind of up for grabs and competing right now. And in one side, the fear that's been brought up by many experts, including even some Republican experts, is that the country may be sort of tipping towards oligarchy, where you have a small group of people who, because of their wealth, can exert undue influence and then shape policy to serve their private interests. And that's what I think most Americans don't want to see happen, but I think that's what some people fear could.
You write about the moderate Republicans who were taken aback by all of the funding that was spent at the state level. They lost their races. A lot of conservative Democrats also lost their races. You quote Steve LaTourette, a longtime Republican moderate from Ohio who was a close friend of John Boehner, and he said he became so frustrated he retired and became a lobbyist, starting an organization aimed at battling the forces of extremism in his own party. He said, quote, "I couldn't take it anymore. I was there 18 years. I understood it was a contact sport, but whether it was transportation or student loans, there were things you do without thinking, and now you can't get anything done." He said some people do not want the government to do anything.
Well, and he's right. I mean, there's a quote also from one of the operatives that was working to fight climate change reform in Congress on behalf of Republican interests. And what he says is interesting. He says that gridlock is our friend. They don't want change to take place, and they don't want compromise to take place, because gridlock really is in the interests of some of the people who want to counter any possibility of reform. But I what's important about people like Steve LaTourette, the congressman from Ohio, who was a moderate Republican, is that moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats who kind of formed the middle ground in American politics are finding it impossible to continue on when the big donors on the far right are calling the tunes. The donors themselves are really pushing the center of gravity in the Republican Party far to the right, and a number of Republicans are uncomfortable with this, but they don't really have the means to stop it right now.
You also report that after President Obama was reelected, a lot of people within the Koch network were shocked and angry, and they got together and talked about why this happened. And they basically said that conservatives have an empathy problem. We are the money guys. The Democrats are helping the poor. Who are we? We're greedy, and we're the money guys, and we have to try to deal with that image. And so what they're now doing is embracing this sort of well-being word, I mean, by talking about how if the poor get food stamps, for example, and help from the government, that affects and negatively affects their overall well-being.
Well, this is the argument. It was so interesting. So, as you said, after 2012, the Kochs and their donor group had poured money into Romney's campaign, and when they lost, they were stunned. And they went back to the drawing board. They're very smart people. They're businessmen. And they tried to figure out where they went wrong. And they did a tremendous amount of market research and testing and focus group testing and things like that. And the research showed them that they had an image problem, that the American public regarded right-wing libertarians as greedy and as the party of big business. And so in order to repair that, they realized they needed to change their image, because they couldn't really get much traction if people, you know, just regarded them as greedy. You will see that this reporting is based on tapes that leaked out of some of the Koch operatives' discussions, where they talk to the donors about the image problem they've got and how they're going to fix it. And what they say is, we need to recast libertarian views as a movement for well-being, that free markets are what make Americans happy, supposedly, and fulfill people. And it's not just about greed, and it's not just about our bottom line. It's really about bringing well-being to the whole country. So there's actually been a well-being initiative that's been funded by one of Charles Koch's foundations, and you'll hear the word well-being in many of their press releases now. And they've also started to do a couple other things that are quite interesting in an effort to sort of rebrand themselves as bipartisan and not self-interested.
And, Jane, we have about a minute left. They're also starting to do more interviews to try to rebrand their image. What are your thoughts about how the media are dealing with the Koch brothers? Do you think they're asking them tough enough questions?
Well, I don't. I think I think it's a good start, but they've really not given themselves open, limited interviews to places like the New York Times and 60 Minutes and places where there really are investigative reporters who know how to give the tough questions. They've mostly gone to softer venues.
Jane Mayer is author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What's on your summer reading list? On the next Your Call, we'll ask Copperfields Books' Cheryl Kotler and Green Apple Books' Kevin Hunsinger to share their recommendations for summer reading. We'll also talk about the Bay Area Book Festival, which is on June 4th and 5th in downtown Berkeley. What's exciting you in the world of books? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Your call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.